From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Just hours after delivering a third body blow to the nation with his vote against unions in the Janus ruling, Justice Anthony Kennedy announced his retirement from the Supreme Court on Wednesday. The 81-year-old often sided with conservatives, but on such issues such as abortion, LGBTQ rights, and the death penalty, he tended to join his liberal colleagues on the court. The timing of Kennedy's retirement offers Donald Trump the chance to nominate a second justice to the court, and the president has already drawn up a short list claiming he would like to see someone serve on the court for at least 40 years. On Wednesday at a rally in Fargo, North Dakota, Trump boasted that the timing of Kennedy's retirement was a compliment to him.
Justice Anthony Kennedy, a very special guy also, just announced a little while ago his retirement from the United States Supreme Court. Great man. And I'm very honored that he chose to do it during my term in office because he felt confident in me to make the right choice and carry on his great legacy. That's why he did it.
Trump explaining why Kennedy retired when he did at a rally in North Dakota in Fargo on Wednesday. Democrats immediately protested the Republican president's right by invoking GOP Senator Mitch McConnell's unethical blocking of Obama's appointment after Justice Antonin Scalia's death. Progressive Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren said Mitch McConnell should follow the Mitch McConnell rule. Let the American people have a say when women's health and equal rights are on the line. The hashtag midterms before SCOTUS has begun trending wildly. Joining me to examine what options the Democrats have, as well as what Kennedy's legacy has been, is Corey Brettschneider, a professor of political science at Brown University. He's the author of When the State Speaks, What Should It Say? How Democracies Can Protect Expression and Promote Equality, and Trump versus the Constitution. His forthcoming book is called The Oath and the Office, A Guide to the Constitution for Future Presidents. Welcome to the program, Corey.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here, as always.
So first, let's talk about what it is that Kennedy has done on the court during all of his years before we get into what comes next. He's sort of been seen as a swing vote often, but this past week, as I mentioned, three massive and devastating Supreme Court rulings were the result of his vote joining the conservatives. All three cases, the Muslim ban, the so-called pregnancy centers, the anti-abortion groups, and just recently, of course, the Janus ruling against public sector unions, all had Kennedy joining with the conservatives on the court to hand conservatives a victory. How do you summarize his legacy?
It's mixed. Just as you said, he is the pioneer of gay rights jurisprudence, and it's probably the most significant development on the court in the past decade, that we have constitutionalized, rightly in my opinion, protections for gay couples and ultimately for gay marriage. And he is, I think it's not an exaggeration to say, the sole reason why that happened. Not just in terms of him being the swing vote, but he developed the doctrine of gay rights really from nothing. When he began on the court, gay sex was criminalized in many states. And the Supreme Court, in a case called Bowers versus Hardwick, held that that criminalization was constitutional. Now, the Supreme Court, in a rare instance, actually just said they were wrong. And an opinion that he wrote in Lawrence versus Texas said there is there are gay rights to sexual intimacy for straight and gay couples. In another extremely important case in the court's jurisprudence, especially of gay rights, in a case called Romer, Justice Kennedy said that a plebiscite passed by Colorado voters that basically revoked the civil rights of gay residents of Colorado was unconstitutional because it was based in animus. That was his term. And that doctrine, the animus doctrine, has become a crucial part of how the court, when it wants to, can fight prejudice. So that's the good stuff. To me, the really awful thing that's happened recently is not only that he voted with the conservatives on the travel ban, but that he really betrayed his own jurisprudence. This idea of animus, I think, is no more clearly exhibited than in the president's tweets and statements. And there, Kennedy just failed to do what his own jurisprudence required. He should have said, with Sotomayor and the liberals on the court, the four justices that dissented in that case, that President Trump's tweets are an instance of racial prejudice and prejudice against Muslims.
Lower courts did take those things into account, but the Supreme Court's five conservatives didn't.
The four dissenters certainly did, yeah. And citing a brief amicus brief that I worked on, Sotomayor said exactly that. The majority said basically the president has extreme deference in matters of international relations. And Kennedy signed on to that. He had a very weak friend of mine, Stephen Mezzi at The Economist, called it a weak sauce concurrence, where he sort of said, well, maybe we could revisit this in the lower courts. But I mean, to me, that was a real cop out. We have enough evidence of the president's animus. We're not going to learn more about his tweets from going back and revisiting this in the lower courts. So, yeah, he betrayed his own legacy, in my opinion. And, you know, this isn't any case. To me, it's up there with the worst Supreme Court cases. Korematsu upholding Japanese internment of Japanese Americans, Plessy versus Ferguson, the idea of separate but equal, and this. And he was on the wrong side of history and the wrong side of his own jurisprudence.
Are those cases that you just cited, are those the reasons why you told Politico, no matter how eloquent and powerful his past defenses of dignity and equality may be, Kennedy's legacy will never recover from his tacit acquiescence to the racism now emanating from our nation's highest office?
Yes, I mean, I think he is the pioneer of this amazing jurisprudence, this tool that the dissenters on the court in this case were willing to use to stop a bigoted president. And when he had the opportunity to actually do it, he was nowhere to be found. And so, yes, you know, I'm not going to deny that he has done all of these important things in the past. But this case, more than any other one, stands out as one that will live in infamy as a disgusting acquiescence to a president's racism.
Well, do you then take issue with those who have called Kennedy one of the few politically independent justices on the court? He has often been referred to as a swing vote in a lot of matters, just because he has on occasion voted with the liberals on the court and on the issue of LGBT rights has been a leader.
I think that on the issue of LGBT rights, he is not just a leader, but a pioneer. And that's not a small area. As I said, it is the civil rights movement of our time, and the court has taken a lead role that we can be proud of. So on those cases, you know, he deserves to be lauded and appreciated. But an abortion, he basically, you know, protected Casey and Roe and the right to an abortion in this country while he was on the court, and there he deserves credit.
I understand, but the death penalty was also one issue where he basically voted with his conscience.
Yes, occasionally. I mean, I would like to see the Supreme Court return to the jurisprudence of the 1970s in the Furman case and acknowledge that this is a violation of cruel and unusual punishment. He never quite went that far and certainly didn't lead a majority in saying that. But yes, I mean, there are areas where he voted with the liberals, certainly. But I guess my point is, you know, when you assess the legacy of a justice, you really can't say, well, he was a good justice, but he voted with the majority in Plessy versus Ferguson. I think that is at minimum a stain on legacy. And that's why I'm, this was a bad term in general for him, but it was really a disappointment. I guess what really irks me, to be frank, is that he, just 21 days before the travel ban case, in a case about this cake, found a way to
the masterpiece not, cake yeah, shop not, case.
Exactly. This was the question of the Colorado Civil Rights Commission denied a request to a baker who, for religious reasons, didn't want to bake a cake for a gay couple. Now, that case could have come out in saying that there's a right of religious people to a constitutional right to opt out of civil rights legislation, including for gay couples. Now, Kennedy didn't do that. True to his legacy of gay rights, he refused to say that. He said instead that when you look at the statements of the commissioners, they showed bias towards the cake maker. They were basically anti-Christian. And to me, what that was doing was propping up this doctrine of animus. But now, in a much more that doesn't seem like an obvious case to me, but, you know, I can see what he was saying. But when it came to the much more obvious case of President Trump's travel ban, there he was willing to say, you know, I'm going to let this one slide. And that, to me, is really inexcusable.
I want to play a video of a press conference that President Trump held on Wednesday ahead of his rally in Fargo, North Dakota. This is among the comments that he made to the press about Kennedy's retirement.
Justice Anthony, you know who I'm talking about. Justice Kennedy will be retiring, and he is a man that I've known for a long time and a man that I've respected for a long time. He's been a great justice of the Supreme Court. He is a man who has displayed great vision. He's displayed tremendous vision and tremendous heart. And he will be missed, but he will be retiring. And we will begin our search for a new justice of the United States Supreme Court that will begin immediately. And hopefully we're going to pick somebody who will be as outstanding. So I just want to thank Justice Kennedy for the years of tremendous service. He's a very spectacular man, really a spectacular man.
Trump lauding Kennedy for being a spectacular man at a press conference in Fargo, North Dakota on Wednesday, the day that Kennedy announced he was retiring. Corey Brett Schneider, should we consider the timing of Kennedy's legacy, or rather the timing of Kennedy's retirement to be part of his legacy? Trump has taken it as a personal compliment to him that Kennedy is allowing Trump to replace him. And you would think that given Kennedy's leadership on the issue of LGBT rights, his support for abortion rights, etc., that he would have thought twice about retiring during Trump's tenure. Doesn't giving Trump the authority to replace him betray his positions on those issues?
Yes, I completely agree with what you're saying. I mean, he's spent a lifetime, you know, building this principle jurisprudence, this legacy that I talked about. And one problem is betraying it in the travel ban case, but resigning with a president devoted to basically overturning this agenda, I can't understand it. Now, you know, people have personal reasons. He could be sick and we don't know about it. There could be family obligations, as there were with Justice O'Connor, that are calling him away. And, you know, that it's hard to fault somebody if that's really what's going on. But it is hard to notice that, it is impossible to not notice that he's resigned in the midst of what I think of as a constitutional crisis, a president who is not just betrayed the Constitution, but is hostile to it. And now he's going to get to pick a justice. I mean, I'm worried about what kind of person Trump will put before the court. And certainly it will be a person who is devoted to destroying the legacy that Kennedy has built up. I mean, the most obvious place is abortion rights. I just don't see how, if they get a justice through, at least a justice that they want, that there'll be a right to an abortion in this country in the near future. I think that at minimum, the states are going to be able to decide. It could be that Congress passes a law that's upheld by the court banning abortion nationwide. In the most extreme instance, I had an article in the New York Times about Justice Gorsuch's jurisprudence, where he contemplated, at least theoretically, the possibility of a national ban on abortion imposed by the Supreme Court. Because if the fetus is a right to life, then equal protection would demand that it's a murder to abort a fetus. Now, that's something he's theoretically toying with. But now imagine that he has 5 votes, which is possible going forward. All these sort of nightmare scenarios now are not just the stuff of textbooks, but they are very real.
There is a short list already that Trump and the GOP are considering, some of whom aren't even judges. And I'm sure there's nobody on there that is going to be anything other than to the right of Kennedy, even. Now, let's talk about what Mitch McConnell did during Obama's tenure when Justice Antonin Scalia died and why the precedent that he set shouldn't apply now. When Scalia died. Obama, knowing that he was going to face a massive fight from the Republican-controlled Senate, offered up what he thought was a moderate judge, a Merrick Garland, who might have been somebody like Justice Anthony Kennedy. I suppose we won't really, we'll never know. And Mitch McConnell said, you don't have the right to do this, even though, of course, Obama clearly had the right to do it. Explain to us, remind us what it was that, how it was that Mitch McConnell justified it and got away with preventing Obama from appointing Garland.
I should say too, just to reiterate your point, if Merrick Garland's nomination had gone through and we had a Garland justice rather than Justice Gorsuch, these cases would have come out differently. That travel ban certainly would have been struck down. I can't imagine Merrick Garland voting with the conservatives on that case. And we would have had a real check on presidential power. So it really mattered. How he justified it, he said some words about why in the last year of a presidency the court doesn't nominate people, that historically is not accurate. The duty of the Senate is to have confirmation hearings and to vote up or down on a nominee, and they refused to do that. They got rid of the filibuster rule, which means that basically the Republicans are going to be able to get now whoever they want. Yeah, it's depressing. I'm usually very optimistic. But.
So McConnell basically said that it wouldn't do for a president to put this forward in his last term in office because he was basically a lame duck. Here we have, which of course didn't make any sense. It really was Obama's right to be able to put forth a judge. Here we have a situation where we have a president under investigation for some very serious issues who has, you could write a book about the corruption that his businesses have engaged in, about the wrongdoing that is coming out every day, even from the Mueller investigation. And some are now saying that until the midterm elections go forward, which could hand the Democrats a Senate majority, Trump should not be allowed to nominate somebody, especially given the position of this president. Does that logic hold any water? I mean, essentially, McConnell broke the rules. If he broke the rules, anything goes, right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the world in which the Democrats repeatedly lay down for the Republicans and allow them to do whatever they want and don't fight back, it seems bizarre to me. This future of the court is the most important thing that we're facing right now. The Democrats have an obligation, given what happened in Merrick Garland's case, to say, no, we're not going to accept it. And as you say, this isn't a normal precedent. I mean, imagine Richard Nixon in the midst of Watergate trying to push through a nominee. I think people would say, no, who are you going to decide whether impeachment is the right course or resignation?
Had McConnell not stood in Obama's way, the Republicans, would not, be able to oppose. The Democrats would not be able to oppose the Republicans on this as much. In a way, McConnell has set the tone, right?
I think there wouldn't be the principled basis that there is now, which is, when things are uncertain, basically, in electoral politics, we should wait. That seems to be the precedent. But I also think there's a difference. Obama wasn't a president that disregarded the Constitution in the way that Trump did. So even if the debacle hadn't happened, I think I would still think we have to wait until we see what happens in the midterms before we move forward with a pick. So, I mean, maybe he'll surprise us. He could pick somebody. In the best case scenario, which of course is not going to happen, Merrick Garland should get this seat. I don't see that happening.
That would be one way forward to bring peace between Republicans and Democrats. Of course,
I've been saying somewhat sarcastically, but maybe we should float it that Trump should nominate his sister, who was a liberal appellate judge, and duke it out with the Federalist Society and others who want to see a purely conservative justice. That would appeal to his family instincts. She seems to be a good judge. So that's
really?
The one point.
Okay. Let's talk about what the process is, just to clarify. The president nominates someone to the court when there's a vacancy, and it's on the Senate to approve, right? And you just need a simple majority, not a supermajority?
There used to be a rule in the Senate called the filibuster rule that applied to Supreme Court justices, which said that You know, even though technically the Constitution only requires a majority for confirmation of a Supreme Court justice, you needed a supermajority under the Senate rules. Now, during the Garland debacle and during the last year, McConnell basically got rid of the filibuster rule for Supreme Court justices. Actually, I think that happened during the Gorsuch nomination. I'm sorry, I misspoke. During the Gorsuch nomination, it wasn't clear that they would have the supermajority, so they just got rid of the rule. And now it's just a, you know, there's no supermajority that's required. It's just a straight majority. And so, yes, they can basically get through whoever they want.
That's another way by which the Republicans have really changed the rules. Had Kennedy simply waited till after the midterm elections and, you know, assuming the Democrats might have gotten a majority in the Senate, then the rules that McConnell changed would have come back to bite him, because the Democrats could have essentially opposed any nominee that they didn't like coming from Trump. So now you basically have to have all, because the Republicans have a very slim majority, Trump's task is to pick a nominee that all Republican senators will unite behind. That is not an easy task necessarily, right?
I'm not sure. I mean, I like to think during the Gorsuch nomination, for instance, I was hoping that Senator Collins and other moderate Republicans, relative to the most extreme, especially on issues of religious freedom, on issues of abortion, might play a role. But, you know, Justice Gorsuch is about the most conservative justice I could imagine. I find him equally conservative, you know, if we're going to put it in those terms, to Justice Thomas. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, I hate to sound cynical, but I think they're going to get whoever they want.
Is there anything the Democrats could do to stop a Trump, a crazy right-wing Trump nominee?
I think that they really have to vet seriously in the hearings, you know, certainly any ethical issues if he appoints somebody of limited ability, that might be one way to do it. That's the first thing.
Can they drag out the hearings? I mean, honestly, at this point, civility has to go out the door when things that are so important are at stake. What can they do?
I wish I could give you a magic bullet, you know, and good news. But no, I think that there's no filibuster rule. There's no supermajority requirement anymore for Supreme Court justices. So a majority can do it. And I think they have a majority on basically whatever they want. What the Democrats need to do is to dig in the hearing and make this about the issues that we're talking about: abortion, gay rights, the future of our fundamental civil liberties. And I think the best that we can hope for is that the country starts to understand in a deep way how much is at stake and how bad things can get and how important the Supreme Court is on these issues. And that's something that I tried to bring out during the Gorsuch hearings. I know we talked about it, and the Democrats, people who were fighting the nomination, got some traction, but it went through. And it wasn't the national, kind of a appalled state that we should get. Now, a lot of Democrats also said he's not so bad. And, you know, frankly, that was wrong. He is that bad. And we just need to be more vigilant, I think, this time than we were during the Gorsuch nomination. I know that it can stop it, but it can put the issues on the table for the midterms and certainly for the next presidential election.
And just finally, the list that is now being touted as the one that Trump is definitely going to pick from it's a list of 25 people. From what I can tell, there are only 3 women on this list. I mean, just given that there just hasn't been gender parity in our Supreme Court for so long, there's never been gender parity. It would make sense to replace Kennedy with a woman. And of course, it's not that hard to find a super conservative woman either, but just for the sake of representation, one might hope that that's the very least that the conservatives could offer. But yeah, just 3 or 4 women in the list of 25, mostly men, that are now the short list of people to that Trump will pick from.
They very well might pick a woman, but let's remember the example of Clarence Thomas. You know, to me, it's going to be not much comfort if it's a woman that's writing the opinion, reversing Roe, or upholding a national ban on abortion passed by Congress, or in the very extreme instance, saying that the fetus has a right to life, and so there needs to be a national ban on abortion imposed by the Supreme Court. And, you know, of course, gender parity matters, and it matters that there be diversity on that court in a way that there has not been in the past and is starting to be now. But it, again, it's going to be cold comfort if it's the means that's used by the Republican Party and Donald Trump to rid the country of our civil rights. Let's not forget what's at stake. It is democracy itself. This is a national crisis. It is definitely a constitutional crisis. And this pick is going to push us further into it. I wish I had better news, but that's the reality of where we are.
If Trump picks a young justice, we could basically see somebody on that court for a generation, 40, 50 years, which is what he said he wants to do. The Washington Post had an op-ed, don't want a right-wing Supreme Court, do everything you can to stop it. Unfortunately, the editorial by E.J. Dionne Jr. doesn't offer much by way of actual actions people can take, because as we've talked about, there really isn't much. But do you think finally that street protests or just petitions, which is what people are now circulating, can at least send a message to the Republicans, the future of your party, the little tiny bit of credibility, crumbs of credibility you might have left, are at stake?
Yeah, I think that's right. That's the way, you know, there have been political parties that have disappeared in the past. The Federalist Party is no more. They passed an Alien and Sedition Act banning criticism of the president of the United States. That's one reason why the country turned against them. And I'd like to see that here. But as you said, I mean, showing how much is at stake, they might still, just because of the Trump presidency, get enough members of the court to haunt this country for 40 years to come. And so the future of the republic will be majorities, hopefully electing politicians that will stand up to them. But that's what we're facing, is a future of the Supreme Court versus the people.
Corey, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. I hope the next time we talk, we have better news to discuss.
Okay, thank you.
And that'll probably be around your new book, which congratulations on that, by the way. We'll have
thank
you back
you so
on
much.
Then.
Yeah, you can pre-order on Amazon.
My guest is Corey Brettschneider, professor of political science at Brown University. He's the author of When the State Speaks, What Should It Say? How Democracies Can Protect Expression and Promote Equality, and Trump versus the Constitution. In September, his new book will be out called The Oath and the Office, A Guide to the Constitution for Future Presidents. We've been discussing Justice Anthony Kennedy's legacy and the fight to replace him. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.